With great power comes great responsibility.
Compromise where you can. Where you can't, don't. Even if everyone is telling you that something wrong is something right, even if the whole world is telling you to move, it is your duty to plant yourself like a tree, look them in the eye, and say, no, you move.
Never step onto the battlefield of ideas unprepared. Before you enter the fray, you need a plan. And there's no better place to get one than right here on Tactics with host Caleb Colquitt. The Situation Room goes live now on News Radio 1440.
Welcome in, one and all. Thank you for being with me on this Monday. By the way, I did get the comments. I just got them a little late. I do apologize for everybody for Friday's show. It was a great show. And you'll just have to take my word on that, because even though there was a video of it, there was no audio, so I wound up scrapping the whole thing. Honest mistake, it happens when you're working on a live program. Sometimes technical issues arise, and I couldn't tell that there was no sound, because I can hear myself in my headphones. I can't hear myself broadcasting, so because of that, I had no idea that the sound was not working. So I do apologize for that. Thank you so much for sticking with me and trying to warn me about that. I have a hard time keeping my eye on the contents when I'm trying to pay attention to doing a good show, but I will try to look at that and keep a closer eye on it from now on. So a couple of housekeeping things right off the bat. I do have to hold on for a little bit. There is going to be a little bit of turbulence in this flight, as it were, because I'm not exactly sure what's going to happen tonight with the national championship and the Biscuits game. We might have a Biscuits game, we might not have a Biscuits game. And so, just out of an abundance of caution, what we're probably going to have to do, since we're running the game on 1440 tonight and we need the sound studio, we're probably just going to have to wrap it up a little bit earlier than normal. I'm shooting, hopefully, for 6 o'clock p.m. sharp. And so what we'll try to do is we'll try to squeeze everything in, but I got to tell you, after missing the show Monday and the abundance of news that happened over the weekend, I'm not sure that we're going to be able to do it, but rest assured, we are going to try. So taking your calls, 860-1440, if you do want to call in. You also have the option of tweeting me at Tactics Radio. Either one of those are perfectly acceptable, and we try to take your comments and share them on the show because this is an interactive format. So, before we get to anything else, because I do think this is the most important issue that we can talk about, one of the things that is really, really tragic about not being able to go back and look at Friday's show is one of my guests, my guest that I had scheduled and was very generous in giving us time. It was very difficult to work out her busy schedule. It was Representative Terry Collins of Decatur. And we do really appreciate her coming on to the program. I just hate that there was a technical glitch that did not allow us to actually give you the audio of that, because it was a really great interview, lasted about 20-25 minutes. And the reason that we had her on is because she was doing an interview about her new bill that she has introduced in the House of Representatives that is a full-on ban on abortion. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to kind of go through the highlights really quick to give you a summary of that, since we were not able to deliver it to you on Friday. So there were a couple things that I wanted to mention about it. First and foremost is pretty much everything that I had reported about the bill beforehand wound up being more or less true. The only thing that was a little bit off, according to her, is that the 2 weeks thing, it was essentially something that was added in the narrative later. So the original bill that was put forward is essentially just a straight-out abortion ban. So the 2 weeks thing that was presented in the news media earlier, and that's exactly where I got it from multiple news sources, she's saying that's a little bit of a misnomer. That's not something that's actually in the bill itself, even though it's technically true, because most women don't find out that they're pregnant until 2 weeks. The bill's language itself pretty much just bans abortions altogether. Now, there are a couple of notable exceptions, and that was one thing that I found really interesting, because Planned Parenthood has already come out after this, and one thing that they had sort of responded to this, the ACLU, of course, also responded to this, they said that this bill was going to be a death sentence to women. The problem with that logic is twofold. First of all, when it came to Planned Parenthood's opposition to this. They were essentially saying that it was going to be unhealthy for women because this was going to cause women to die because of this restrictive ban. The problem with that assessment is that there actually is a carve-out in this ban that makes exceptions for life of the mother. Now, there are going to be conservatives that are mad at me for saying this, and I understand that, but even though morally I do think that it is completely incorrect for a mother to choose to save her own life over that of her child, I do believe that actually from a legal standpoint, strictly from a legal standpoint, there is at least an argument to be made. And the reason that I say that, not even saying that the argument should go one way or the other, I'm just saying that from a legal perspective, if the sole desire, the sole purpose of the law is the preservation of life, and you're put in a medical situation where you could have an abortion and save either the mother's life, or you could not have an abortion and lose the child anyway, and possibly the mother as well, I understand from a legal standpoint, and only a legal standpoint, the argument that you may take the option of taking the child's life in order to preserve the other. Same thing with, for example, conjoined twins. If you're having a surgery to try to separate conjoined twins or something, and you hit a wall, and you can either run the risk, and a very high risk, of losing both of them, or you can kind of pay special attention to one and making sure that that one lives, even though you're pretty sure you're going to lose the other one. I understand, again, strictly from a legal standpoint, that you would want the law to reflect the preservation of life. Now, that being said, that's one major flaw with Planned Parenthood's argument that this would be, quote, a death sentence to women in the state of Alabama. The other big problem with that is that even though I just talked about the legal argument for this, it pretty much never comes up. And what I mean by that is there was a time, if I'm understanding this correctly, and I've spoken to somebody who was an OBGYN for a very long time, knows this industry in and out, that there were situations that could sometimes arise where an abortion would be medically advised from the standpoint of preserving the mother's life. That's not really the case anymore. And one of the OBGYNs that I spoke to on this matter, he was in Boston, so not exactly a place where you have a lot of conservatives and a lot of anti-abortion sentiment. He said, look, just from the standpoint of being somebody that delivers babies for a living, I've done hundreds upon hundreds, probably thousands of births, and I've never even heard, not that I haven't encountered, I have never even heard of a situation where an abortion would be the medically advised course of action. And the reason that he said that is because it would be so difficult to be in that situation, because in every situation that ever arose where complications happened that he had been in, the advised solutions were to induce labor or to perform an emergency cesarean section. That's it. And neither one of those two have anything to do with killing the child. Because if you induce labor, it actually helps expedite the process for the baby to be alive. Having the baby alive as opposed to stillborn is preferable. And the reason for this, or the cesarean section, is because if complications during birth arise, and you're trying to save the life of the mother, an abortion would actually slow that process down. In other words, the woman in these situations would be more likely to die as opposed to less. Because what you do is you go ahead, you get that baby out of her without performing an abortion. That happens more quickly so that you can get to the business of stabilizing the mother. If you want to perform an abortion, you have to perform the abortion, then you have to get the child out of her, then you have to stabilize her. It adds an extra step, and it actually makes the procedure more dangerous. And again, don't take my word for it. Talk to some of the medical community. And this is, like I said, an OBGYN that's not necessarily pro-life. He's just saying, look, I've never encountered situations where an abortion would be a correct course of action. And so Planned Parenthood is wrong on two levels there. First of all, like I said, there's a carve-out for the life of the mother in this bill. And secondly, and most importantly, even if that carve-out weren't there, the chances of there even being a situation that could arise where an abortion would be necessary to save the life of the mother is so astronomical, it's basically not even worth considering. I'm just speaking in sheer numbers of probability here. And so, even though I understand, again, from a legal perspective, the reason for having that exception in there in case a situation similar to that arises, not from a moral perspective, remember, Planned Parenthood's argument falls on its face on two separate levels. The truth is, Planned Parenthood is really worried about this being a death sentence for them, not a death sentence for women in Alabama. What they are truly concerned about is this is going to cut into their business and make it to where they cannot possibly make money. That's what they're scared of. That's what they're worried about. That's the reason that they're opposing this. It's not out of concern for women. It's not because they're worried about the safety of women. It's because they are worried about their bottom line. And they know that they will be basically inoperable. They won't really be able to keep any clinics open in the state of Alabama if this law goes through, because abortion is where they make their money. Do they provide other services? Yes. But they don't make a lot of money off of it. And so what they're counting on is these women coming to them to get different services and an abortion, or at the very least sort of get their foot in the door to buy the bigger ticket items, which in this case would be abortion. And that's the reason that you have to consider this. The reason Planned Parenthood is upset about it is exactly that. The ACLU, its end goal is just as evil. And by that, I mean preserving abortion, but at least its motives are not profit driven. The ACLU may, be an evil organization for trying to keep abortion alive and well and legal in the state of Alabama, but at least they're not making money off of it. And so I will at least say that for them, even though they're on the other side of this fight as well. And Terry Collins did a great job of explaining a lot of this, just a fantastic interview. And one of the things that she talked about with when she wound up getting in touch with Eric Johnston and the Pro-Life Coalition, the people who helped her craft this bill, that it just made sense to her, and the reason that she wanted to bring it forward is because of our neighbors all around us, Mississippi, Georgia, Tennessee, and also Iowa, even though they're not really our neighbors from a state perspective, have already either passed or have considered passing a heartbeat bill. And then the coalition came up to her and essentially said, look, here's what we're thinking about. Even though a heartbeat bill would be an improvement in the state of Alabama, and we currently do not have that protection for the unborn, we think that it would be more profitable from the standpoint of getting Roe v. Wade overturned long term to go ahead and have a full-on ban. And there's two reasons for that. First of all, there's the federalism argument. Because essentially what this does that the other bills either don't do or don't do as well is that you can make an argument of the 10th Amendment to the Supreme Court if it winds up going that far. And so while the heartbeat bill, you can essentially say, look, the states have the right to restrict abortion to this very limited window. And there's precedent and court precedent that you can look at in the past that affirms that. Because we're not banning it altogether, we're not banning it outright, we're just very narrowly restricting it to this small amount of time. You see, what the Alabama law does is it's a completely different take on it, and those heartbeat bills are going to see their day in court, maybe not the Supreme Court, but this thing is going to get appealed, and it's either going to wind up in state Supreme Courts or federal appeals courts. This thing is going to be hashed out at some degree at a higher level than it is now. I mean, that's just inevitable, and everyone should expect that. But the reason that the Alabama bill is somewhat different is you can affirm from our bill a full-on ban on abortion, that abortion should be banned on the not at the federal level, but because Alabama is a sovereign state that can set things like homicide laws and murder laws and the conditions surrounding the criminal code. And so because of that, and because of the way that this bill is worded, it's just a different quiver in the arrow. It's not that the heartbeat bill is bad. It's not that the heartbeat bill isn't a really good law that Alabama would benefit from. It's more from the standpoint of, if the end goal is to end abortion, and of course it is, if the end goal is to get rid of abortion outright, then it makes sense to have several different arrows in the quiver. And right now, we've got the various heartbeat bills that are coming up all across the country. which, by the way, just an update on that, Iowa and Mississippi have passed theirs, and Governor Brian Kemp of Georgia has signed that one into law. I'm not sure about the Tennessee one. I don't think that it has made it to the governor's desk yet, but I know the one in Georgia has passed, and we're actually going to talk about that in just a second. But those bills have passed, and those are one of the arrows in the quiver right now. The other is the one that our friend Sam McClure and Laura Glidewell have come and talked to us about. You'll remember my old co-host actually came back to talk about some of the work she's doing right now with them. Personhood Alabama doing some amazing work with this. They are taking the stance of paternal rights. In other words, when a baby was terminated without the father's say-so, without the father's consent, he is suing over the estate of his son or daughter. I'm not sure. I guess it would be a son because he's named Roe. But anyway, that was the case that they're bringing forward. And so you're arguing the same thing, that abortion should be illegal. You're just arguing it from a different perspective. And one of the things that's really significant about that case is it essentially presupposes, just by being considered, that the unborn child is indeed a person with rights to life, liberty, and everything else that goes with that. And so what you have here is a second arrow in the quiver. And then the third arrow of the quiver is the one that we just talked about, the full-on ban of abortion in a state. And so maybe all three of these arrows hit the mark. Maybe none of them do. But the point is, it makes a lot more sense to have different arrows if you're trying to kill the beast that is abortion, this grotesque leviathan that exists and is a stain on our national history. If you want to kill the beast, it makes sense to have multiple arrows in your quiver. And that's essentially what Terry Collins is trying to do, and that's what the state of Alabama is trying to do. The odds are this bill is going to pass. I mean, you have a Republican supermajority in the House and the Senate, and do we get frustrated with them? Yes. Did they do everything right? No. But they'll probably get this one right. And Governor Ivey, even though I have my misgivings about her and I've been very vocal about some of my criticism of her, she has a really good record when it comes to life. And so I fully expect this to wind up on the governor's desk, and I fully accept it to be signed into law, making Alabama the first, to my knowledge, the first state since Roe v. Wade to actually attempt a full-on legal ban on abortion. And I could not be more proud of my state for that. I do hope that this winds up passing. One thing that does give me a little bit of pause, though, and this is one of the things that we talked about in the interview with Representative Collins, one thing that is a little bit I'm skeptical of, there is a carve-out in this bill, and she assured me that she tried to keep it strict, and the requirements, in other words, the bar that you have to reach to get to this level are pretty high, because you do have to have a licensed therapist affirm to the court that this person reaches this threshold, but I'm iffy on this one for sure. The argument here is that not only do you have a carve-out for the life of the mother, you also have a carve-out for the health of the mother. Now, it's not the same as the carve-out for the health of the mother, for example, in the state of New York, which specifically uses the word all factors. So as long as something, all factors, is included in that, which would be everything, you can get a late-term abortion in the state of New York. So essentially, if a woman comes up to an abortion clinic and she's going to give birth like the next day, I mean, any time before birth is what this is included for, and she wants to get an abortion, all she has to say is, yeah, I'm a little low on money right now, and I'm very anxious about it, because it includes things like economic hardship. It includes things like mental health. She could say, yeah, there's some people that they've kind of been giving me the cold shoulder since I got pregnant. I don't really want to be pregnant anymore, so I'm going to just go ahead and have my abortion. So it's not like that. It's not like the law is in New York where health of the mother includes virtually anything. This particular requirement is much stricter than the standard that one set. But I don't like the vagueness. Just saying the health of the mother, that you have to have somebody that's a psychiatrist, and I understand the rationale here to a degree, because the worst thing that could happen, and this was the scenario that Representative Collins brought up, and I understand her concern for this, is that the mother essentially threatens to kill herself and her child, because of course if she's dead, the baby won't live either. That she threatens to kill herself and her child if that doesn't take place. But here's the reason that I don't like that excuse. To me, that's like somebody holding another person hostage. And I realize that there's not a whole lot you can do with it, because especially up to a certain point, you know, 25, 30-ish weeks, depending on the baby itself, it's a hostage situation that you really can't remedy. Because if you're dealing with somebody that has a hostage, in other words, they've got a gun to somebody's head, then, of course, the best case scenario is that you get the hostage away from the hostage keeper. You can't do that in the case of a woman that is threatening to kill herself if she doesn't get an abortion. And I understand that that is a different scenario. I'm not saying this is a one-to-one comparison. But I'm saying the fact that the reason that I'm skeptical of this excuse is if women learn that this is just the magical thing to say to get an abortion, then all women have to do in the state of Alabama is say, well, yeah, I know that abortion's illegal, but I'm going to kill myself, and the baby's going to die too if I don't get the abortion. And so it comes dangerously close to allowing for a loophole that would essentially let anybody that just claims it to do that. And I understand that the claim itself is not what allows you to qualify. I understand that you have to have a licensed therapist and they have to observe the person. But look, I get that medical professionals, especially when you're talking about in the area of mental health, I realize they have a lot of training. I realize that they can usually spot when people are being fake. And I understand from a certain degree that they do the best that they can to be honest about that. And there's an ethical concern there. But you can't tell me that there's at least not a chance, with that provision being allowed in the bill, that a woman just finds a psychologist that is licensed, but also happens to be very pro-abortion and lies to the court and says, okay, yeah, she's really going to kill herself if she doesn't get this abortion. And so I get that that's an incredibly delicate situation, and it's a terrible one that we have to consider. It's horrible that we even have to have this conversation. But I'm saying that there is at least the ability for that to be abused. And that is something that ought to be considered. And maybe the House and the Senate amends that. I don't know. But that's something that I do think that we have to think about. But speaking of that, I did want to bring up that in the state of Georgia, and we mentioned this a little bit earlier, in the state of Georgia, that we had the governor, Brian Kemp, who signed into law an anti-abortion bill. And the reason that especially Georgia has been at the center of a big controversy, even more so than Mississippi, even more so than Iowa, they passed a heartbeat bill. So any child beyond the point that the child has a heartbeat, which by the way is very early, that any time beyond that point where you can detect the heartbeat via ultrasound, that would not be allowed anymore, which is great. That's a big win. But the reason that this was so heated and the reason that everybody was making a big deal about Georgia specifically is that, especially in recent years, Georgia has been a hot spot for Hollywood. You'll remember that The Walking Dead was filmed largely in Atlanta, and that's one of the biggest shows on AMC. You'll also notice that just about every Marvel Universe movie, if you will watch the credits and watch all the way to the end, and you probably have, because let's face it, you want to see the secret ending, the cameo, or whatever else happens after the credits in a Marvel movie. If you're watching that, you'll notice that it has a Georgia Film Association logo. That's because a lot of the Marvel movies, and a lot of other movies as well, lately have been filming in Georgia. And there's a lot of reasons for that. First of all, the tax burden is pretty low. They can film there relatively cheaply compared to places like New York or LA or Hollywood itself. And so because of that, Georgia has seen a lot of wealth, a lot of growth, and a lot of business coming from the film industry. And, you know, good for them. More power to them. But unfortunately, what has happened recently is that because of that, Hollywood, because they have an innate desire to control everything around them, and I don't know why, but they have this desire to control states that they don't even necessarily live in. They have been threatening to boycott the state of Georgia if this bill is signed into law. Now, the previous, and I would say spineless governor of Georgia, when pressure came from Hollywood, when it came about the religious freedom bill, you'll remember, came up in Georgia a couple years ago, they caved. They caved on it, even though all this bill essentially said is that you, if you are a religious person and you own a business in the state of Georgia, then you, if you have a legitimate religious reason for not serving somebody in a certain capacity, and yes, the gay wedding cake or the florist for a gay wedding, those are the kind of scenarios that they were thinking of. These are the kind of scenarios that gave birth to this sort of bill. All it said was, if you are a person with legitimate, deep-seated religious conviction on an issue like this, then you can be exempt from any laws or ordinances that comes to this. And even though this was basically what the law already said, it was kind of a lateral movement, honestly. It just gave a little extra protection to the Christian business owner in this scenario. Hollywood, back then, threatened a boycott. And you know what? It worked. Because the governor backed down, refused to sign the bill into law. And I do think that that is a big part of the reason that Governor Kemp won his election. To do stuff like this. Because now what's happening is that the governor is saying, and he said this specifically in a statement where he was asked about it. He said, you know what? Hollywood's not going to control us. I don't care what the people in Hollywood think. I care what the people of the state of Georgia think. And bravo. That took some courage. That took some gumption. Bravo, Governor Kemp. I applaud you for that. But then, of course, you have his former political rival, Stacey Abrams, who, good gracious, I think it's so weird that the Democrats here recently have liked to back losers. And I'm not talking about losers in the sense that they're deadbeats that live off of the government teat. Because, I mean, they've been backing people like that for a really long time. Bernie Sanders is a perfect example of that, a guy that didn't have a real job until he was 40, and that real job was in the government, and he's been on government jobs ever since. So I'm not talking about losers in that sense. I'm not talking about losers the way that Donald Trump would use, he's a loser. I'm not talking about that kind of loser. I'm talking about losers in the terms of political campaigns. Oddly enough, it seems to be a trend here recently that Democrats have gained some kind of weird affinity for people that lose elections. And in this case, you've got Stacey Abrams, and you also have, oddly enough, Beto O'Rourke, Bob Francis O'Rourke, who is doing really well in the Democrat primaries despite the fact that he lost. Now, granted, give the guy credit where it's due, coming very close to unseating Ted Cruz, one of the best senators in the country, in Ruby Red, Texas, that was an impressive feat. I'm not saying that it wasn't, but it still seems odd to me that the left is rallying behind people that lost elections. I find that really strange. And sometimes Republicans are guilty of that too, and that's not even necessarily always a bad thing. I'm just saying that here recently, it seems to me, and I don't know, maybe it's just perception, but it's weird that the Democrats have seemed to rally behind these figures that are famous for losing their elections. Andrew Gillum would be another, was that his name? I think so. Gillum, the guy who ran for governor in Florida, I think that was him. Anyway, they just have this weird affinity for backing and trying to turn into celebrities people that famously lost elections. And Stacey is no exception to this. She said earlier this week that not only is banning abortion evil, which, we could go back to the scripture which says, curse to those who call good evil and evil good, but nonetheless, I'll just ignore that point for right now. She was saying not only is it evil to ban abortion because you're banning a woman's rights. I guess she's not considering the women in the room or in the womb, that about half of the children that are aborted happen to be female, but nonetheless. She's saying that it's also just bad for business, and she was specifically citing this thing that we were talking about with the film industry, and there are a whole lot of celebrities that are saying that they're going to boycott Georgia, which I saw the list of celebrities that vowed to do that. There were maybe three or four that I actually thought were decent actors anyway. So I really don't think that Georgia's going to suffer much financially from this. But I love the fact that Governor Kemp essentially said, you know what? If we take a financial hit, we take a financial hit. It's the right thing to do. And I admire that. Oddly enough, she is saying the exact opposite. What she is doing is going up and saying, well, it's bad for business, so we need to keep abortion legal. Now, what's hilarious to me is that Democrats suddenly act like they are very concerned about business and very concerned about finances and keeping businesses in a state when it suits their goals. And that seems to be the only time that they care about it at all. In other words, they want the policy, they want abortion to remain legal past the point that you can detect a heartbeat in the state of Georgia. And because of that, they're trying to use the argument, well, it would be financially in our best interest to do so. Who cares? And I say this as a small government, very pro-business right-winger. Who cares if you're making just stacks of money, if you're doing so at the cost of the most innocent among you? Who cares if you're wealthy, if children are dying on your watch? Keep in mind that in Egypt, they were afraid of revolt. They were afraid of the Hebrews rising up, and they were afraid they were going to lose their slaves, and then they have to do all their work themselves. And what was the plan that they came up with to stop this? They killed every child that was male within the borders of the Egyptian kingdom, every Jewish male under 2 years old. All of them. Except for Moses, and that's, of course, where that story comes from. But that was the rule. This was the plan that they came up with. They were willing to sacrifice children on the altar of convenience and financial gain. And that is exactly what Stacey Abrams is suggesting right now. She is saying, well, we want it to be convenient for the woman, and we want to be able to make money and not lose business, so we need to be sacrificing these children. It's a small price to pay, I guess, according to her. These people are like pagans. They are perfectly content with child sacrifice to their gods, as long as it means that they get convenience and monetary benefit, or political gainsmanship in certain circumstances as well. It really is a sad existence. But on the topic of abortion, I actually do have really good news. Excellent news. The movie Unplanned, after its second weekend, after opening weekend, has grossed up to this point $2.5 million. You may remember, after opening weekend, it made $6.1 million. In the span of 1 week, it has doubled its original gross income. That is amazing. Because movies just don't do that. Opening night and opening weekend are really important. And sometimes movies, you know, fall off, they don't have staying power or whatever. But typically, even movies that are popular for a really long time, even big blockbuster successes, they don't typically, after their opening weekend, make double that the next week. Now, don't get me wrong, it's nowhere near the gross income of movies like Captain Marvel and other things that it was competing with, Dumbo and these other films. But I mean, come on. Doubling your income 1 week after your movie comes out? And I do think a big part of that, because movies just don't do that. I mean, hardly ever. I'm not saying there are no examples of this. I don't know. I don't follow it that closely. But that is just not that common. And I really do think that a lot of it has to do with this movie got such a slow start because TV channels were banning it, saying they would not run their ads. We talked about the networks that did that. And you also had its Twitter feed suspended. You had its entire account suspended, and then you had people that weren't allowed to follow it. They booted about 90% of their followers off of their page, made it to where they weren't following the movie anymore. So, I mean, just from the social media side, from the internet advertising side, and also from the TV side, you just saw a massive hurdles for this movie and people even being aware of its existence. But it looks like word of mouth advertising and maybe even little programs like my show and different local stations across the country have been helping with this. I really hope that it has. But unplanned, $12.5 million. And this is a fantastic film. I cannot urge you to see it enough. And just in case you haven't, in case this is the first time that you're hearing about it, we're going to go ahead and take a break and we'll be playing one of their ads. They're not paying me for it. I'm doing it for free. I think that they need as much help as they can get. And the fact that this thing is already a huge success, it has already made 4 times its budget and it's only been out for 2 weeks. So that is really good. 4 times its original budget of about $3 million. So I highly, highly encourage you to go to this movie. If you have kids, I get it. It's rated R. I can see that making you uncomfortable. But if your kids are, I think, about 11 or 12, yes, there are going to be some scenes that are a little disturbing. There are going to be some scenes that you're going to want to, you know, cringe a little bit. But I'm telling you, they will be able to handle it. Teenagers will be able to handle this movie, and they're the people that need to see it the most. So I highly encourage you go see it. We're going to go ahead and play that trailer, and then we'll be right back.
Abby Johnson is in the other room.
Here.
Our first order of business is to present Planned Parenthood's Employee of the Year Award. Abby Johnson.
There's a fire inside, you can feel it.
This is Abby. She's our newest volunteer escort.
Abby, this is Cheryl D'Alessandro. It's a neon
light glowing like a fire. I'd be the youngest director in Planned Parenthood history.
You'll actually be in charge of the abortions at your clinic?
I have a chance to make a real difference.
No matter what you do for the rest of your life, you're still going to be a baby killer.
The only thing that's changed is you, Abby. Can you even hear yourself talk right now about these procedures? These are little babies.
I'm not going to apologize for doing a job that helps women in crisis.
There's still a part of me that is unsure.
I know. But the one thing that all experts agree on is that at this stage, the fetus can't feel anything.
Sorry to bother you, but they need an extra person in the back room. Are you free?
I saw it. It was like it was twisting and fighting for its life.
We commend the souls of these hundreds of children. And Lord, we pray to end abortion.
I really appreciate what you've done for us. I'll not forget it.
22,000 abortions. How do I even comprehend that?
Rough day at the office.
You can say that. You're making a mess.
It's your dad and me. You are our baby from the moment of conception.
We are paying you to be a perfect instrument of corporate policy. We are an abortion provider.
I can't be a part of this anymore. Everything that they told us is a lie.
Don't underestimate the repercussions of this. You gotta be careful.
Rhonda, please, don't do this! Rhonda!
Let me tell you what's gonna happen if you walk through that door.
Congratulations, you have made an enemy of one of the most powerful organizations on the planet.
All right, and welcome back, everybody. We appreciate you staying with us here on this Monday. We got to wrap it up before too long because, like I said, we got a biscuits game coming up and we have to be off the air, have the station cleared for that. If you are wanting to listen to the Biscuit Game, you can do so on News Radio 1440 AM, or you can always check it out on the News Radio 1440 app anytime that you want to. But when it comes to that, I'm just giving you fair warning. There's some concerns about the weather, and because there's some concerns about the weather, we're not 100% sure that we're going to do it. We're going to go ahead and get out of here early just in case, but if you turn it on and you're still hearing Mark Levin, it's not because of something you've done. You're still on the right station. It just happens to be that we had to cancel it. Again, we're not sure if that's going to happen yet. We're keeping an eye on the weather. Chris Adams-Wall, our guy on the ground, is keeping an eye on it, and he'll let us know, hopefully within the next 20 minutes, what we're going to do. So we'll have to make a decision on that. But I did want to go ahead and talk about this really quickly. And this is really strange. I considered doing a Daily Dose of Stupid about this, but I don't know that it's so much stupid as it's just weird. There's a guy that is considering a run for the Senate here in Alabama against Doug Jones, but he's not from Alabama. So there's a couple reasons this is really odd. There's a guy named Matt Gaetz, and he is a current sitting member of the House of Representatives for the state of Florida. He presides over Florida's District 1. So the first district there in Florida, he is their representative. And as far as this guy goes, seems like a nice enough guy, but he has publicly said in a statement to, I believe, The Hill, that he has been approached and is at least considering the possibility of actually moving to the state of Alabama so that he can run for the Senate. And this is a quote directly from him. And yeah, this is from The Hill. I had a few people make mention to me that Alabama has a very short residency requirement, but it's not something I've looked at myself. I think that my most likely path would be to seek re-election in the House. So he's saying, yeah, I probably just wind up running for the seat that I've already got. I probably just wind up trying to get re-elected here. But Alabama does have a short residency, and that seat is coming open in 2020. So he's at least toying with the idea of moving to the state of Alabama to take the Senate seat away from Doug Jones. And this is really odd. To be clear, the way the law states, because he's not suggesting that he's going to be breaking any laws, is you have to be a resident of the state of Alabama for one day in the House or the Senate. So as long as you are a resident of the state of Alabama for 24 hours, presumably, I don't know if that's before you declare your candidacy or before you actually are installed into office, as long as you are a resident of the state of Alabama for a day, then you can run for office. So that's interesting. This guy is actually playing with the idea of being a state senator, or sorry, being a senator for the state of Alabama, even though he's from Florida. All right, then. For the record, he is a panhandler. Because Florida's first district is around, it includes Pensacola and areas like that. So it's not like he's from way down south in Florida. It's not like he's from the peninsula part of it. And so because of that, I don't think there would be a huge culture shock. It's not like this guy is somebody who's an imported Yankee snowbird or something like that. He's not from Miami. It's not some place that's very culturally different. Because let's be honest, the panhandle is basically just South Alabama and Georgia. There's very little difference from a culture standpoint in the panhandle and Alabama and Georgia. There's just not. And so I don't think that there would be a culture shock moving to Alabama or representing the people of Alabama and representing their culture. There might be a bit of a knowledge gap and a learning curve, but I don't think there's going to be a culture shock on that. I don't see that being a problem. So that is an advantage. That's sort of a point in his favor. Here's my problem with him, though. Maybe I would be a little more open to this idea if he were very conservative. He's not unconservative, but he's just not the most conservative. For example, from Conservative Review, he has a 69% lifetime score out of 100. And then from FreedomWorks, you've got 78%. He actually fares a lot better on FreedomWorks, and then 76% on Heritage. So these are all very trustworthy sites. These are all great resources. I recommend that you look up your own senators and your own representatives of the House if you happen to be from Alabama or anywhere else, really, because these give you a pretty good indication of how conservative your representatives are. 68%, that's a D. And 78% is a lot better, but let's be honest, it's still a C. It's still like middle of the pack. And I get that there's a lot of Republicans with records that are a lot worse than this. I mean, I'm not saying this guy is Lisa Murkowski. I'm not saying that he's Suzanne Collins, but it's not like he's Mike Lee or Ted Cruz or any of those guys. So just my initial reaction is, even if he is eligible to run and it wouldn't be a problem there, I don't think I'd want him running. Just personally, I don't think that he's somebody that would be all that conservative. I'd rather have somebody more in the mold of Mo Brooks. That's the candidate that I'd like to back right now, even though currently he hasn't announced yet. I suspect that he will. Jim Ziegler has also talked about running. I would love to see Jim Ziegler up there. I think that he would be more conservative. I don't see this guy pulling off a successful candidacy in the state of Alabama. Not saying it can't happen. Not saying there's absolutely no way. I'm saying I don't see it, and I don't really think that he should do it, and here's why. If he were saying that he would move to run for an empty seat in the House, I would still think that was odd, but I don't know that I would see that as a disqualifying factor. And the reason for that is, like I said, there wouldn't be much of a culture shock. The people in the place that he's from are not that much different than the people in the place that he would be representing. And that's the thing. The House of Representatives is the representative of the people. There's a reason people call it the people's house. That's what the House is supposed to be. That's not what the Senate is. People say that all the time, but no, that's not what the Senate is. It is not supposed to represent the people itself. The Senate is supposed to represent the state as a whole. In other words, the state as a sovereign individual entity, as a not an affiliate of the federal government, but a sovereign entity in and of itself with its own separate laws and its own unique culture and everything else, that is codified in the Senate. That is the place where those values are supposed to be represented, and that's the reason that you get equal representation. Because in the House of Representatives, since you're representing the population, it really matters that Texas is a lot bigger than Maryland. It matters that California is a lot bigger than Rhode Island. Not so in the Senate. What you're supposed to be doing in the Senate is looking out for the interest of the states as entities, and on that ground, they're all equal. That's why they get two senators. Everybody gets two senators. And so I might even be a little bit more open to this guy running if he were moving to run for the House of Representatives. I don't think it's right that he's moving to run for Senate. And that kind of brings me to my final point that's kind of a strike against him too. It's one thing to say, I want to move to the state of Alabama, and I would also like to run for Senate once I get there, and saying, I'm thinking about running for the Senate, and because of that, I would move to Alabama. You see the difference there? He's not saying that I want to live in Alabama. He's saying I want to be in the Senate and I'll move to Alabama if I have to. That's the difference. This guy, it seems to me, and I don't know him, he may be a perfectly nice guy, but it seems to me that what he's saying is I want to be a senator, not I want to be Alabama's senator, just I want to be a senator. And even people that have moved to different districts, and usually this happens in more local elections, for example, Cory Booker, who's running for president now, he famously bought a residency in Newark so that he could run for mayor of Newark because he didn't live there. So what he had to do is he had to set up shop and get an official residency within the city so that he could run for that office. And this happens all the time in local elections. I'm not using it as a slam against Booker. I'm just saying that this happens a lot. But at least then they kind of pretend like, oh, well, I was going to move there anyway, and I just happened to want to run for office. This guy's not even putting up the facade. He's essentially saying, yep, I'd really like to be a senator, and because of that, I may move to Alabama so I can be a senator. You got it backwards there, bud. I just don't think that that's right. But speaking of that, speaking of people running for that Senate seat, we have a new contender. I want to put up the new challenger approaching screen from Super Smash Brothers. In fact, I may do that for the next time somebody announces their candidacy. We have a new candidate in the race who has officially announced, oddly enough, via Twitter. I mean, usually they have formal events or whatever. This guy just tweeted out, yep, I'm running. So that in and of itself is interesting. And it is Tommy Tuberville. No, you didn't mishear me. Tommy Tuberville, who used to be the head football coach at Auburn. That's him. He is running for office and he's running as a Republican. Now, granted, I didn't see all of the interview that he did earlier this week, this weekend, sorry. But what I did see was the excerpt. He sounds like a very stereotypical candidate. He talked about his pledging his loyalty, essentially, to Donald Trump, kind of trying to kiss the ring there. He also talked about how liberals are ruining this country and they don't even want to abide by the law. By the way, looking through all of that, he didn't say a single thing that wasn't true. But the reason I'm a little skeptical of it, and keep in mind, I'm an Auburn guy. I love Tommy Tuberville. I was mad when they fired him, to be honest. But when it comes to being a senator, I'm a lot more confident in somebody like Mo Brooks, who has been to Washington and been at that level and had the opportunity to be corrupted and instead chose to remain a conservative and has a consistent voting record on that. Bradley Byrne, to a lesser extent than Mo Brooks, but still somebody that has held very conservative values for the state of Alabama. Jim Ziegler. I mean, Jim Ziegler is the person that calls out corrupt people. That's just who the guy is and has been for a long time. I trust all of these candidates more than Tommy Tuberville. Not because I don't like Tommy Tuberville, or that I think that what he's saying is insincere. I'm just saying that when people go to Washington, they tend to get more corrupt, not less corrupt. And I don't know that Tommy's corrupt right now, but I'm just saying that people tend to make a lot of promises, and I'd rather have somebody with a proven voting record. Now, who knows? He has a lot of time to change my mind. This thing is a year and a half out. Maybe I'll wind up pulling the lever for Tommy Tuberville. I don't know. But at this point, I severely doubt it just because he doesn't have the experience at this point. And experience does count, and it should count. So, Tubbs, look, you've got my interest. You've got my attention. You have an opportunity to win my vote. The ball is in your court now. That's all I'll leave it. You have to convince me that you will be a better representative than any of the other people that are running. And like I said, right now, Mo Brooks actually hasn't technically said that he's going to run. I suspect that he's going to, but he may not. But even so, you still got to convince me that you're better than Bradley Byrne and that you're going to be better than Jim Ziegler, who I'm almost 100% certain is going to be in the race. And that's going to be a tall order. But I'm willing to hear you out. Let's go to the chaplain's report.
In 1775, the Continental Congress created the Chaplain Corps. Under the command of General George Washington, each soldier was required to attend worship service every Sunday. While other armies advanced on their feet, Washington's troops advanced on their knees. It's time for the Chaplain's Report with Caleb Colquitt on tactics.
Chaplain's report today comes from the book of Proverbs. And one of the things that I think you really have to understand to really get the full grasp, to grasp the entire concept of this proverb, because just the words itself are good if you knew nothing about the author and didn't even know who wrote it. But knowing that Solomon wrote this proverb, I think gives it extra weight. And here's why. King Solomon was one of the wealthiest men on earth in his day. When you talk about the 1%, there would be people in the 1% that didn't even come close to Solomon's wealth. I mean, this guy was at the top tier. He was the Bill Gates of his day when you're talking about wealth. And yet, he was a man that ferociously and often talked about the virtue of hard work. Now, he was a king. And what he said pretty much went. It would not have been all that difficult, especially considering that his father David had won lots of spoils of war to kind of give him a good head start on this. It would not have been hard for King Solomon to have lived in the lap of luxury and not really had to work all that much. And yet every indication that we're giving from the scripture is that he liked to work, sometimes even manual labor, things like gardening. And farming and working with his orchards, this was a man that understood the value of work despite being very, very, very rich. I mean, super duper rich. And I recently got into a discussion I say that. It really wasn't that recently. It's been a while now. But I got into a discussion with somebody, and I remember them saying to me, and this person was somebody on the left, they said, it's just a terrible thing that hunger still exists in the world. And I know that what he's talking about, and I said as much when we were having this discussion, was abject hunger, somebody that goes consistently several days on end without a meal and has no ability to get one. And there are several countries in this world, unfortunately, where that does still happen. Extreme poverty is still a problem, and I'm not saying that we ignore that. But sometimes I think we go a little bit overboard on that and throw the baby out with the bathwater. Hunger is not in and of itself a bad thing. We as human beings feel hunger because it urges us to work. And so when you're talking about a hunger that drives us to go out and to seek and to serve our fellow man so that we may gain something in exchange for our hard work, that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. God made us with hunger for a reason. He gave our bodies the ability to do that. And we're going to see some of the wisdom in that coming from Solomon. And this comes from Proverbs chapter 16, verses 26. A worker's appetite works for him, for his hunger urges him on. So one thing that I want you to really zero in about that verse is that it's saying that the appetite, in other words, the hunger that a worker feels, it's an advantage, not a disadvantage. And what's the advantage there? Because a man that is hungry works harder. Not somebody that's a skeleton and can barely lift anything, but it's saying that somebody who has a desire for something, somebody that has a desire to feed himself and to provide for his family, that appetite is good because it spurs him on. It gives him the motivation that he needs to work hard. And there's something that I also need to address too. Sometimes I think even those within the church, sometimes even Christians that are devout, have an unhealthy view of work. They almost view that once we get to heaven, that there's going to be no work. Now, I do believe that heaven is a place of rest, and the Bible does back up that idea. I'm not saying that that's not an aspect of it as well, but I also don't get this idea where there's going to be no work once we get to heaven. I want you to remember this. God could have made human beings to not have hunger, to not need to work. And yet, here we are. Yet we do have that hunger. We do have the need to provide ourselves nourishment. Even in the Garden of Eden, before the original sin took place, there was still fruit all around. And presumably, they had to go out and get it. Now, they didn't have to work real hard for it. They didn't have to till the soil like they did after the fall of man. But they did have to go out and acquire food. And Adam had a job even before the fall of man took place. He had to keep and dress the garden, and he had to care for and name the animals. And so this idea that paradise is going to be free from work, I don't get that indication from the Bible. Every indication that we're given is that God's perfect world and his perfect creation includes work as a part of the process. And we need to remember that, that God made us in this way, and that we don't need to throw out the baby with the bathwater. Our appetites, our hunger, our desire to do good, our desire to serve our fellow man, a lot of that comes with our original sort of base desire to need to provide for ourselves. And that can spur us on to good work because God made human beings to work. And ultimately, through that, he teaches us an important lesson through almost a parable. He sends us this lesson that everybody can understand. Everybody can understand working because you're hungry and you want something. And because of that, isn't what he's really saying here that we need to work for him, that we need to do God's good work, that we are his workmanship created to do good works? And if that's the case, well, what's our appetite for that? What's our appetite for wanting to do God's work? Our appetite should be for him. Jesus said countless times that I am the bread, I am the water that you will drink and never thirst again. You see, we need to hunger after God. We need to have an appetite to be with God and to be in his good favor. And doing so will spur us on to do his work. That is work worth doing. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics is a production of News Radio 1440 and Cumulus Media Montgomery. Any opinions expressed on this program are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Cumulus Media. The theme song for Tactics is 6 Foot Town by Big and Rich. Graphics by Jessica Dawson. Broadcast studios provided by Cumulus Media Montgomery. Location studios provided by the Dalreda Church of Christ. Copyright 2019.